You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and before we enjoy this conversation with Maeve Higgins, just time for me to tell you about my tour. I'm into the second quarter of the tour now, and I'm going to be visiting the following places very soon: Reading, Corsham, McCunclith, Bristol, Bath, Norwich, Northampton, Warwick, Shrewsbury, Swindon, Farnham, Aldershot, Sheffield, York, Newcastle, Leeds, Southampton, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Birmingham, Brighton, London, Tring and Cardiff. We just threw in Tring as the penultimate one there as a bit of a dafty. So if you fancy coming along and seeing my stand-up show Like I Mean It, one of the 20 best-reviewed comedy shows at last year's Edinburgh Festival, get yourself to comedianscomedian.com/tour. Now, a conversation with Maeve Higgins that I recorded at South by Southwest, the incredible interdisciplinary tech, music, art, comedy festival that takes place in Austin, Texas every year. I was enormously excited to be invited to go along there and check out some of the incredible stuff that they have on offer. There was an awful lot of robot arms. I'll tell you about that later. But there was also fabulous comedian Maeve Higgins, formerly of Ireland, now relocated to New York. And I can't wait for you to hear what she has to say. This is the brilliant and very funny Maeve Higgins. I've never been to Texas before.
Yeah.
This is your first South by Southwest as well.
It is, yeah, yeah. I think I remembered as I was coming here and we drove by a barbecue place, I was like, I've eaten there before. So I think I was here before with Eugene Merman for a Star Talk taping, which is like a science and comedy live podcast.
Okay.
But I didn't remember that. I just remember that we had like this good barbecue. Because if you like, if you go on the road with Eugene, like it's basically like a gastronomical tour.
Oh, man.
He knows every like the best Szechuan spots, like the best pizza spot. Like he just is a real foodie, and that's obviously heaven.
Yes.
You know,
yeah, that's, I think, I believe that Ross Noble and his friends, who are also his crew, just ride motorbikes all the time. Just like they get, there's no gear. So they just go, oh, this gig, and then an amazing motorbike thing.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
A foodie version of that sounds fun.
Yeah, like I wouldn't be able to be in Ross Noble's gang because I'm not into, you know, I wouldn't ride a bike. Like, I'd just be like, be careful, you know.
Yeah.
And also, we have very different styles of comedy. Whereas, like, with Eugene, I think I love his comedy. And also just, like, I'm so down to just, like, eat heavy meals.
Well, this is, tell me how long you've been in America. Because I think one of the things I particularly want to talk to you about is how non-American your act is. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I think of
yeah.
the Americans that I see come to the UK, and a lot of them, the ones that I see here at South By, which is what the cool kids are calling it. but it's always seemed to me that their stand-up is very punchy and gag-driven, and that is sort of the opposite. I'm not saying you don't have gags. Of course you do. You've got good, great joke structure.
But that girl's got gags.
Yeah, but it's... But your stuff is so sort of deliberately meandering, and do you know what I mean? I just love that, and it seems to have made no concession at all to the fact you're in the States. So tell me about how far back shall we go? How long have you been doing comedy? Let's do a potted history.
Okay, so I've been doing comedy for 11 years. Started in Ireland and in Dublin, and then lived in London for a year, like I guess 5 years ago, and then from London came, now live in New York for the past 4 years. So my stand-up has dropped off in that time. Like, I was definitely more of a stand-up and doing all the festivals for years and all that stuff. And like you say, not very, you know, set up punchline, like more of a kind of storyteller who like forgets halfway through and tries to, you know, that's my style I've discovered over the years.
Yes.
And yeah, so I guess, yeah, 11 or is it even 12 years now? I don't know. And I've been in America for 4.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what prompted the move to America?
Well, it was, I always had like a romantic thing in my head about being a writer in New York City. And so I always wanted to do that and do more writing. And it's, the distance from Ireland is quite healthy, I think. It's like 5,000 miles and like it's like a 5-hour trip. So it's not like crazy far from home, but it's like far enough that I could get some perspective and like be anonymous myself in New York. And now I think the more pertinent question for me, for your audience, is like, why would I stay here? And now it's like a very interesting time to be here and to be living in America as an outsider, and watch what's happening here and be in a lucky position that I'm in to like comment on it and write about it and try and figure it out as it's happening.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel that, I mean, because obviously what's happening here with regard to Trump and the, you know, the way that that's kind of specifically what you mean? The
yeah, I do. I mean,
kind of emboldened the right.
Yeah. And I think that it's, you know, it's just a fascinating time. It's kind of maybe the end of the American empire and like their imperialism has to come to a stop now. And it's just fascinating to see that happen. And it's also really tragic, like all these big endings are. And I think that's what's keeping me here now, you know. What? I'm really interested in immigration too, and to see how immigrants are being treated here and to just bear witness to like the unfolding horror dog big picture is like astounding to me. Yeah.
Is there any difference in the way that you're treated as an immigrant?
Oh, hugely. I think that's why I got so interested, because comics who want to come and work here, especially white people and Europeans, are more likely to get it, apply for the Alien of Extraordinary Ability visa, which is called the O-1, which lets you come here. You have to prove that like you're better than that. You're like this magical angel who has skills that nobody else does. And you basically get letters from your fancy friends in high up places, and you get like some pages of press that you've collected.
Okay. So I hadn't realised those additional things. I didn't realise he was trying to reduce legal migration as well. So is that what you mean by the end of the empire? Like that's the whole idea America, isn't it? Isn't that the basic idea of America, is send me all your...
It's like that's the idea of America. You can definitely argue that that was never the case, because it's a country that was built on genocide and slavery. But like, I think seeing America from the inside, where like all these kind of ideas about itself are crumbling, and then seeing it on the outside where it's losing face on a, you know, international scale every day. Now, you know, this might date the podcast, but like now, you know, he's going to go and meet Kim Jong-un, and it's like a former American leader would never have done that, you know. So it's seeing it happening from the inside and the outside. I think America's power worldwide is really fading. And here, like the day after Trump got elected, like the most, the stocks that rose the highest were in immigrant prisons. So it's a very money-based too. Like the whole thing is really sort of gross, like troubling.
And is this, do you inquire into this stuff in your stand-up or in your kind of writing and podcasting more?
I talk about it in my stand-up, but I always am grappling with like, how to talk about a serious thing in a funny way and like not to like punish the audience and be so earnest and, you know, but I have to say like I'm more drawn to, this is more interesting to me than doing gags at this time, you know. So I still do stand up, but I don't want to be one of those like, hey, I'm just like figuring something out politically on stage. Like, I don't think that's fair. Like, I think people want to come to stand up to laugh and have a break and not have to be confronted with like some like privileged person finally realizing that like things are real, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I came to this after like a long, like the year before last, I did a comedy workshop in Erbil in Iraq. And it was like, I met all my Iraqi peers who have been, you know, through so much. Like, it was in Erbil, which was half an hour from Mosul, which then was under ISIS control, right? So some of them still had family living in Mosul, and some of them had, you know, friends who'd been killed in bombings in Baghdad. And, you know, like, they're Iraqi, like, they're, no family has been untouched. So, like, I was there, like, supposedly leading this comedy workshop, trying to be like, hey, jokes help, you know, and like, let's set up this alternative to, you know, ISIS are very, or definitely were very powerful on social media and like with video and everything. So the thinking behind the workshop was like, you know, we can fight that with like humor and like, here's another way, like here's a different narrative, you know, of like embracing life and being funny as opposed to like total destruction, which was ISIS' favored method. And so it was really interesting. That workshop was really cool. And I learned more from them than they did from me. And it was just like, that really made me think, what really is the power of comedy? Like, is it powerful? I think we, or I don't want to speak for you, but definitely I would hope like that it works. But then I see all these TV shows, like late night shows, which are such a US tradition, like speaking truth to power or whatever. And like, look what's happened here. Like, yeah, we have Last Week Tonight and we had The Daily Show, but like, look what's happened. Like, we have a super nationalistic government. Like, we have like immigrants being criminalized every day and like the way black people are treated in this country. And I don't feel like that was addressed before. So what are these rooms doing?
Yes, it's just kind of preaching to the converted liberal bubble kind of, you know, yeah. People aren't, or people don't seem to be, setting out to convert anyone.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've been listening to what like Stephen Colbert is saying more recently, and he's kind of saying like, oh, our show is a space to like laugh and breathe and like not necessarily be preached to or whatever. But then I watch the show and I'm like, you're just like making fun of Trump's hair. Like, what use is that to us, you know? So I think comedy is comedy and it's great, but I'm just more interested in other ways of actually you know, I guess more political ways that actually maybe are impactful.
So when you talked about this trip to Iraq, did you originate that yourself? Were you sent there? Was it your idea?
No, I was asked to go there by a friend of mine who I was friends with as a journalist in New York. And then he started to work for this organization that was kind of backed by like the British and Danish governments, who were working like with young people in Iraq. And now they've kind of expanded to Syria too. To, you know, support people there, to give them other things to do rather than just be, because like, you know, the education system is really buckled there, and there's just so much there's like so much catching up for them to do. Like, say if you want to go to college but you're like 19 and you live in like Sulaymaniyah or something, it's really hard to do that. So they were like, let's provide, you know, ways to support, like, there's a pretty thriving scene of like, not so much stand-up comedy, but like satirical groups and like theatre groups and cartoonists and stuff. So they're like, let's support those lads and see if there's any more people who want to join in. So they funded these a few workshops. And so I was asked to go. And so I went with Joe Randazzo, who was an editor of The Onion. And then he worked at Midnight. And I went with Mo Ammer too, who's like Dave Chappelle's like touring companion. And he's hilarious comic in his own right, and he's, you know, from a family of Palestinian refugees originally, and then he grew up here in Texas, so he speaks Arabic and he speaks English, and he's hilarious and cool. So the three of us went off and did the workshop. Yeah.
Okay, how did you feel going into that environment?
I mean, I was, you know, I had a lot of you know, imposter syndrome, because I was like, who might go and talk to these people in a war-torn country about, like, this is why comedy is important. And I felt, you know, just the usual stuff, like, what am I going to wear? Like, leading a conference, you know? Like, the usual stuff. I didn't think really, you know, like, oh, I'm going to be, like, 20 minutes from ISIS. Like, I wasn't worried about that. But I didn't, like, tell my family and friends that I was going. I just, you know, I said to my mom, I'm going to Kurdistan. And she never clicked that, like, okay, Kurdistan is in Iraq, whatever. Sure. So it's like,
do you feel powerful as a comic? when you're performing?
In the moment I do, like, say if I like win over a crowd, or if I think like, oh, they doubted me and now they're laughing and like I win or whatever. But the time I feel most powerful, which is like something that like is something that Mahatma Gandhi said, which is, I'm going to misquote him probably, but it's basically like, when what you feel and think and say like all matches up, that's like when you're like at your most powerful. Or like at your most like true to yourself, which is like another way of being powerful, I think. And I can't seem to get that on stage. Like, I can get close to it on stage where I'm like matching up my brain and my words and my emotions, but it's really hard to get that exactly, I think, on stage.
What kind of bits are you doing when you get close to that on stage?
Well, actually, it's often like if I've had a really bad day and it's like the sad parts of my life or like the bad things in the world, when I'm talking about them, that it seems to be I'm the most lucid. And that's like, I think, not the healthiest for me. So like what I've over the years, I've worked out that writing is better for me because it gives me the time to like filter and edit and like really get clear, like, what do I think and feel and what am I saying here, you know? And that's become, you know, like I said, I did stand up for many years and like I would get close to it, but I think it's with writing now, it's a more efficient way of like expressing myself.
And when you say you're writing, I know you've written a book, which I am afraid to say I haven't read.
Oh, don't worry. It's fine. Yeah.
I was doing a load of pre-kind of research and I didn't know if I had you on the show, so I had to prioritise other stuff.
Yeah, I know. And it's
normally
like,
I would have read your book and I'm annoyed by that.
Can you take time at South by Southwest to like read a comedian book? So now I'm a contributing op-ed columnist with the New York Times, which is a really good big platform to have. And so I'm doing that. And then I have a book coming out with Penguin in the US in August. So I've written that book and I'm just like waiting for it to come out, basically.
Okay. The last time we saw each other was, it must be 3 years ago. It must be 3 years ago. I saw you and Beth Stelling at the Punchline in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I think it was either the following day I got engaged, I proposed to my wife.
Yeah.
Or it might have been the previous, I would like to.
Yeah. So you were high as a kite.
Yeah,
like
high
on life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember talking to you at the time. I thought your set was just fantastic. And me and my wife still giggle about the Coke full of babies, with just babies spilling that bit of stuff. And then not that we can remember it kind of photographically, but that idea of like, you know.
Yeah.
Just loved it. I remember chatting to you briefly afterwards and you were talking about the financial pressure of being a comic in New York compared to being a comic in Ireland or in London.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think the bit that sticks out was you were saying you were walking dogs.
Oh,
I
wasn't walking dogs, but I was definitely babysitting.
Oh, okay. But it might have been
babysitting. And those seem to be the two things that we do when, like, new to New York comics move to New York. It's like dog walking or babysitting. They both pay like around $20 an hour, I think, or something like that. Do they? I don't know about dog walking, actually. But yeah, 3 days a week I would babysit when I first moved here. And because like, what the thing is, like, people who in London and Dublin and stuff don't understand is like, you do not get paid for shows here. Like, you could even do, like, I didn't get paid for last night's show that I did. Like, you get, you know, and actually maybe I shouldn't say that for this festival, because like, whatever, you know, they fly you out and they put you up and whatever. Mm-hmm. But like, you do shows in New York and there's like hundreds of people in the audience and there's not even a question that you might get paid.
Yes.
I do not understand it. Like, I was like, what am I missing? Like, when I first got here, I was like, what am I missing? Because like, I come from London where, you know, like, you do a few shows a week and you get like £60, £100, like not even clubs, just like your friends' shows or whatever. And you're kind of kept ticking over in that way. But that just doesn't happen here. And I think it's because, you know, it's like cutthroat America. Like, if you don't want the show, we got like 10 people lined up or whatever.
Yeah, it's
got
to be supply and demand ultimately.
Yeah,
it?
I think so. And there's just not a question here of like, it just seems to be very much like you either like really make it in comedy here. And you, as in like your Amy Schumer or your like Dave Chappelle, or else like you do not make it at all. and you just stop doing comedy. And like, I don't know what happens to you. You just end up in a different, you do advertising, or you like become house husband, or like, I don't know. But there doesn't seem to be like this happy medium of like, oh, this is like a great outlet for my creativity and I'm going to do this and that, you know. Like, so for me, I don't make any money from stand-up. No, I still don't, really. Like, I guess, like, so I'm here at this festival. I didn't get paid for last night's show. I'll get paid for tonight's show. It's like $500. It's not like a, you know, living wage. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, good for a festival, actually, to pay you that much. I'm sure there's people here doing just free shows.
Yeah.
And it's, like, not even on the table. It's not even a discussion people have. They're like, yeah, like, we're lucky to be doing this.
It's weird, isn't it? It's,
yeah.
Like, I do wonder whether what the market forces are. Like, was it 40 years ago you could get paid for doing shows, but now there's so many people available? Or was it just never? It was always just assumed, like, oh, if you want to, you can get up and work.
Yeah.
It seems extraordinary to me.
It's got to be something about America and, like, about capitalism. It has to be, because it's, like, you're just, like, on your own here. Like, that's it. It's, like, okay, you want to contribute? Good, we'll take all you can give.
Yeah.
And then it's, like, you can be lucky and, like, there's this lie of like working hard enough, but like I've been in comedy for long enough that I can see, yes, it's definitely about hard work. I mean, you've got to see this all the time. Like you have to see this all the time talking to comedians. It's like,
yes,
it's about hard work. Yes. But it's so much to do with just like luck or like happening to meet this person or like just, it's very arbitrary. And like, even if you talked to me a few years ago, I probably would have been like, you know what it is? Like, you just, like, gotta get out there and you have to do your writing. And, like, I know a guy who wrote, like, 12 pilot specs in a year. And, you know, sit down and do your... But now I'm kind of like, chill out, because it's just luck.
Like, it's like... That is not a common message on this podcast, but it's lovely to hear.
Yeah, because people really... And the thing about it is, too, I feel like when people get lucky and get the break, they kind of forget and they're like, you know what? I do deserve this.
Yes.
They're like, yes. Yeah, for years I lived on noodles and...
Yeah.
But you know, I'm really talented and I deserve it. But it's like...
Whenever anyone says, oh, well, comedy's a meritocracy, I always think, no. Oh, really? Are you better than insert name of brilliant actor who isn't very successful? Like, is that what you mean? Like, oh, it's a meritocracy and I'm successful, so I guess I must be amazing. Yeah, I suppose... I mean, maybe we all deserve it. Maybe because we've all lived on noodles. So it's easy to kind of, when someone breaks through, you go, well, I really earned this. You go, well, the rest of us also really earned it, but we didn't get it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I haven't got it yet or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So you it's interesting you talk about, you know, you give and they'll say, oh, great, we'll take everything. That's a really fascinating way to look at it. When you talked about moving to New York originally a few moments ago, you said anonymous. You said you had this... dream of coming here and being anonymous. Why did you want anonymity? What was it that was attractive?
Well, I think that gives you much more freedom, like creatively. And I think that, you know, coming up in Ireland, I think I had only been doing stand-up for a year, and then I got a part on a hidden camera show that was really fun and silly and also really popular in Ireland. So people knew my name and my voice. And so it was harder to like kind of fuck around and just do fun stuff and like figure out what type of comedy I wanted to do.
Okay.
You know, because I had just a bit of a profile, which, and I'm not being modest, but like Ireland is so tiny that it's like not hard to, you know, if you're on a show, like people will know you. So I think it was cool for me to move to a big city where like nobody had a clue who I was, and so I could just literally like meander around and go to like secondhand shops or whatever and just like figure out my voice.
So this is Maeve, just a joy to talk to, a fantastic comedian, an incredible imagination. One of the things I noticed afterwards in my notes, I must start showing you some of the things I write in my notes beforehand. One of the things I very infrequently refer to them, I try not to have them visible during interviews, and then every so often I finish an interview and I think, I look back at them and go, no, I didn't even mention that. She has on her Spotify album such a phenomenal bit about gang, being in a gang and then leaving a gang, and she says, you do know one of the things they say, they have this phrase, don't they? Like, oh, please don't leave the gang. You know, if you are going to leave the gang, try not to do that. It's just, she just does that lovely, I think I mentioned it in the interview, that thing like Alex Horn, that brilliant way of coming at a subject from a completely new angle, from almost like just an idea that you can track in her stand-up from B to A. Fantastic. So more from Maeve in just a second. You all know about the tour coming up. I rattled off the next part of the tour schedule. Schedule, I really minced that. When I was in Texas, I tried to say schedule to someone and I couldn't remember if schedule was the English or American pronunciation. And I think I just said schedule. A former girlfriend of mine years ago used to think that the word bounce had an X in it. She always pronounced it bounced. And it was just one of those things she'd picked up as a kid. I mean, that's weirder, if anything. It doesn't illustrate any point. But back to Maeve shortly. You know about the tour, and those of you who are still donating to the show, thank you very much to everyone donating with a regular subscription donation via PayPal. That option is still very much available to all of you. It is a tiny percent of a fraction of an iota, to borrow the language of Stephen Fry for a second, of the total listenership of this show that actually put their metaphorical hand in their metaphorical pocket and give me actual money. So if you would like to be included among them, then please do go to comedianscomedian.com/donate and you can support this show in a deeply alluring and sexy financial manner. You can also do that via patreon.com/comcompod. So have a look at that if you are signed up to Patreon, which is a really... It's a very usable member thing. I met a guy from Patreon at South By, which is what all the cool kids are calling it, and they really are. God, they're cool. They're all cyborgs. But I met a guy from Patreon, had a really good conversation about Patreon membership and how it's kind of, how they're tweaking and changing the way it works. And so I have to say, if you're part of the Comedians Comedian Podcast Facebook group and you were baffled earlier this week by having lots of people post the phrase "Go Team," that is simply because I was trying to test a function of Patreon and how quickly and whether people would respond to it. So apologies if that made you feel out in the cold. It was quite a just a fun little test. I just wanted to see how quickly people would react to a thing. I do mail outs. I mean, not often, we know that, but I spend so much time kind of talking up the mailing list and flyering people after gigs and saying, hey, join the email list. And then half the time I send a thing and loads of people, months later, it turns out, didn't get it. So I'm just sort of experimenting with different forms of doing that. Nonetheless, that is how you can donate at /donate. And you can also sign up and get hold of all of the various goodies available, free albums and so forth, all from comedianscomedian.com. Now, I squeaked then. I literally trod on it. Oh, I'm just going to redo that so you know that it wasn't some awful bit of flatulence. I'm walking around backstage just before my Nottingham tour show, about to go on in a couple of hours, and when I think some comedians would be, oh God, it's really squeaky, I'm wandering around. I'm a pacer. I'm a backstage pacer, and I'll try and remain rooted so as not to squeak further. I think when a lot of comedians are sort of, what's the word, devolving, relaxing into some sort of pre-stage recuperative coma pre-show, I'm often doing admin, but some of the admin I'm doing is to write the jokes for the second half, and I'm getting pretty excited about the second half after a crazy little gig in Mayford, me neither, in a little scout hut as sort of a fundraiser for a local kids football team, and there's some belting new gear and it's really working. I'm really enjoying the second half of the tour being the sort of preview slash workshop section. It seems to be getting the stuff together, which is an enormous relief to me and everyone that's coming to the rest of the tour, I'm sure. Now, let's get back to the second half of this conversation with the fabulous Maeve Higgins.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So you're talking about coming from Ireland and searching for something here that, you know, a bigger place. Is that in order to kind of prove yourself, to prove to yourself that you could thrive in somewhere huge?
Yeah, I think that you don't move to New York unless you're very ambitious and you're very, like, you want to prove something. But the thing with me is, like, I was never clear on what that was. Now it's definitely coming into focus and I'm like, I want to be a really good writer and I want to, like, make stuff that, like, is actually, like, helpful in some way, you know. And that's coming into focus for me now. But I think, yeah, like, you don't really move unless you and I'm talking about, like, as a privileged person, like, you don't move unless you want to and you have, like, bigger hopes for yourself than what's, like, available at the time, you know. So I think that's why you left. Yeah,
it strikes me as particularly fascinating when someone who does, I don't want to use the name whimsical comedy, but, yeah, you know, your stuff is, how would you describe the kind of flavour of stuff that you do before I proceed with the question?
Yeah, I would say it's like silly. I would say whimsical is a fair word. And it's kind of like storytelling. And yeah, I think that's the type of comedy I do.
When you combine that with ambition, I think that's a really fascinating mix, because I think the whimsical comics that I know, like, there's a sort of, I don't know if it's a trope, that's maybe the wrong word. There is a thing in British comedy at the moment, I think, where in the last 5 years or so, people started to do comedy knowing that they weren't going to make any money from it. So they were just free to take wild risks and be incredibly creative in a way that probably when I started 12, 13 years ago, I wasn't kind of in the wake of, like, I'm going to play Wembley and become a megastar. You know, that hadn't quite happened yet. Mm-hmm. But it was sort of like, oh, I'm just going to gig. I'm just going to get by. That was the sort of the framework for, oh, you do this and you gig and you get by.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in what it's like to be a whimsical comedian, like a really, and I used the word meandering before, and I don't want my listeners to think there's anything negative about that, but something in, like, there's a lovely line in your album that's on Spotify where you're saying that you have to do comedy because you, I'll murder it now, I'm sure, but it's something like, so I can't drive or type and I can't do surgery, you know, I'm not a surgeon. And yeah, it's just such a wonderful, do you know what I mean? It's that sentence is just such a lovely journey of coming at something from a completely unexpected direction, right. You know. So to take that sort of wandering kind of loose comedy style, when you are someone who is ambitious and has got the gumption to uproot yourself and go to America, like, do you feel... I'm not quite sure what the question is.
I know, because even as you're saying it, I'm like, that's like something that I definitely grapple with too, because part of me is like, you don't want that career stuff. Like, you're fine. Like, you know, what's more important to you is, like, you know, really experiencing the world as it is. But then I'm like, well, be honest, Maeve. Like, why did you move to... This is me having a conversation in my head.
I'm loving the two voices. We're going to talk about those two voices at some length, so feel free to continue inhabiting them.
What about me? Don't forget about me. Yeah, like, you know, to confess to being ambitious and to, like, wanting more than just to be, like, a sweet presence on stage or whatever. That's, like, something that I had to kind of admit to myself, I think. And, you know, that does help you to, like, focus more, I think. Because as well, I do wonder how much, like, because I'm female and Irish and, like, how much I chose that way of doing stand-up, or how much it just, like, all these invisible forces, like, pushed me into that.
Can you describe some of the invisible forces?
Well, their nature is they're invisible and they're really hard and they're veiled and it's really hard. But like they've kind of, you know, I've got some clarity around them. Like the older I get and the more I see my peers and people younger than me, and I'm like, oh, like I guess misogyny is a huge one. And, you know, also I think being a white person has definitely like made me a certain way. And definitely, yeah, like me being a woman in this particular world at this moment in time, just as much as it would shape like a man's comedy or a man's experience of the world. But I think for women, a particular thing happened, I think with me, where it was like, I could see myself like, okay, people will listen to you if you're very non-threatening. And like, you can maybe get your message in sly ways and you can get it in at the side and stuff. If you are this like... I think non-threatening is like a good word for it.
Much harder to be your kind of Bill Burr punchy stand-up. Not harder to be that as a woman, but harder to the people react. It's one of those ways in which there is that internalized, or not, I don't mean internalized, but kind of an implicit misogyny of like, oh, you're seen as bossy. You know, those kind of ideas where you're like, oh, if a guy does this, then it's fine.
Yeah.
And if a female comic does that, then it projects a particular thing, not because it projects it, but because everyone receives it.
Yes.
I feel like I made a hash of explanation, but you know what I mean?
I know. But like, I'm telling you, Stu, it's like hard for us because we're just like dumb comedians. It's like really hard for us to like put it into words. And I feel like maybe someone
You are talking about us comedians,
not us
women.
Comedians.
we're really dumb. Well, this is not what I expected to talk about.
Fucking women, man. But I think like, you know, it's really easy. Or like, I definitely used to be like, I want to do this comedy this way. But now I'm like, maybe a sociology professor or something could actually like break it down. Like, why do you do comedy the way you do and I do it the way I do? And like,
yes,
you know, who are the way our families were. Like, I was brought up Catholic. Like, I'm sure all that stuff plays into like how ultimately like I present myself on stage, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's an incredibly mature thing to be able to step outside of what you were doing before. And or maybe what you're still doing in your stand-up, and be able to look at that. I think that's why it hurts so much if you are a skinny white guy with big hair and jeans. If someone points out that you're a skinny white guy with big hair and jeans, because it's so much a part of your identity and who you are and how you express yourself.
Yeah.
When someone points out, oh, that's because you've been shaped by these particular invisible forces, you feel like, no, I decided. And you, well, did you? You know, that's really, I've not really had another guest talk about that. I wanted to sort of stay with that for a second. Not maybe just in terms of what the forces are, but how you're able to recognize them. Like, is it just kind of a burgeoning awareness in yourself? Is it something that you've seen when watching older material of yours? I just want to talk a little bit more about the process by which you become aware of the decisions you previously made and how they acted upon.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe
think...
the most esoteric question I've ever asked, but I think, again, I think I feel like you know what I mean.
I mean, I know it is indulgent to, but like the thing is, it's really work. You have to work on it, and you have to like, I don't know when it start, but I think I always felt a bit of dissonance when I was like, that's me on stage, but like in my head, that's not it. Like I'm not hitting it. Like when I see my 2-year-old niece, she like doesn't have a huge vocabulary, but she has such strong opinions. And I'm just like, I get it, you know. And so I think like for me it was just a lot of reading and like figuring out, you know, like writing, like I said, is really helpful to me, and like trying to think, well, what do I think and why do I think it and where do I fit in this big scheme of, you know, the human race or whatever. And I think it does take time. I think in your 20s, you're so in it and you're so close to yourself and you're sure that like you are the person that you are and that you've made all these choices leading to it. And it's hard on the ego. Like it's really hard on the ego to be like, wait, like I'm just a collection of like learned neuroses and like, or like different, you know, scams that these people have been running forever. And now I see why, you know, where I fit in. So, yeah, I think it's just a bit of self-examination, I suppose. And, yeah, it's you know, not the most fun thing.
How do you... when you talk about writing, particularly kind of writing longhand, you know, writing not for stand-up, you know, not in a kind of an abstract, hey, writing on stage, but actually physically sitting down and writing for an article or a book, and the process of self-examination that you undergo, how do you stop that from being kind of a wormhole of introspection? Because I feel like that's... I wrote a show years ago that was kind of the starting point was I wanted to write about anxiety, my anxiety, and it was a torturous process that made me very anxious, and I'm reflecting on all this negative stuff in a non-healthy way. How do you examine yourself without it becoming a kind of vortex?
Yeah, so two things. You have a good editor, so that's an outside set of eyes that isn't just like an adoring fan. Like, it's like a objective as possible set of eyes who's like going to look at your work and think like, well, what about this? And what do you really mean here? And, you know, pull this extra stuff out of you. And I think another thing is, and because we're comics and we're, you know, introverted thinkers, if that's even a term, I think it is a danger that we do that, like, and that we do get deep into ourselves and go around in these circles, and it doesn't help anyone, especially not ourselves. So I found the last 2 years, like, looking outward has actually led me to understand myself more. So, like, when I was doing
you almost sighed as you said that, like, oh, this is a really obvious narrative conclusion.
Yeah.
Oh, what I was looking for was with me the whole time.
Yeah, because I didn't. I was like, I felt to myself about like 4 or 5 years ago, I was like, I am so sick of myself, like, I don't want to think about this anymore, like, I'm going around in circles, and like, I just want to expand my thinking. And so you know, one way was for my podcast, I would interview a different immigrant each week from a different country, and I would learn all about the country and like the system that they came through, and I would also just learn about their lives and make a platform to for them to tell their own story in their own voices, right? And so but of course, that just led to me learning a lot more about what Irish Americanness is, what Irishness is, and what being white means really in America, and, you know, my own sets of drawbacks, privileges, blah, blah, blah. So I think in answer to your question about like when you start writing about yourself and you get trapped, I think looking outward is always good, and also trusting someone else to, you know, handing it over to someone else, to a good editor. And like, it doesn't have to be like an editor at Penguin or whatever, but it can be, you know, a good reader that you know, like somebody that's close to you that you trust.
Did you choose your first editor, or were they kind of thrust upon you by a book deal?
My first editor in Ireland was, yeah, she kind of came with the publisher. So I didn't choose her, but I was very happy with her. Mm-hmm. But my, my current editor now, I guess we went out with my agent to sell my book, and I met a lot of different editors at different publishing houses, and she was like really sharp and cool. Like, I was like, oh, I hope that I get her. Mm-hmm. Sarah Stein, her name is, at Penguin. And then my editor at the New York Times, is like, again, I didn't choose her, but I feel like really lucky to have her, because she's like a lot more, she's a lot cleverer than I am, and she has more scope. Cause like, how much can we do like with one tiny brain, right? Like, just muddle through this like one thought. Like, if I can even get to the end of one thought, it's like my day is bliss, you know. It's just like, oh my God, like, we're so limited. So I think having someone, her name is Rachel Dry actually, and having someone like Rachel, like, take my work and try and use the scope that she has to make it stronger is like it very valuable.
So just because I've never really spoken to people about editors before, because I'd love to have for the writing of a stand-up show.
Yeah.
I'd love to have someone go, oh, you're doing that thing you do again, or, you know, whatever those kind of things. So can you talk about some of the maybe pit them against each other? Like, what are the two different relationships you have with those two editors, and what are some of the strengths of those relationships? What are some of the most useful things they've confronted you with?
Yeah, so I think that's interesting about stand-up, because I think it would be so helpful to have an outside pair of eyes on us. Like, one of the beautiful things about stand-up is that it's very much one person, you know, and it's our point of view, and it's like, you know, idiosyncratic, and that's what you come for and that's what you get. But I, you know, what are you going to do that for 40 years? Like, how are you going to develop and learn? And, you know, I think like finding your voice in stand-up is one thing, but then it's like, really, that's it? You're happy with that? Like, you're done now, you know? So anyway, with my editor...
So I'm just going to pause on that for a second, because what an incredibly good point. I really thought, like, it's this kind of... I think part of me is a sort of a thing that I probably lazily kind of rest into, is this idea that I'm always, I'm traveling hopefully, and I'm always trying to find and refine and redefine that thing. But that is just one quest, isn't it? Like, there could be other quests. You could just go, I've had enough of it for now. Something else could pull it in a different direction.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, ultimately this isn't like to make stand-ups feel any type of way, but like, I just do think that we could help ourselves a lot more too, because sure, all you have anyway in the end is you and your own little thoughts and your own brain and voice. Like, that is it, like, right? But to try and expand them in ways that are challenging and hard, and like, definitely with their writing, like, I think I'm drawn, especially my writing, to be like quite maudlin, like quite like maybe a bit melodramatic actually.
Okay.
So definitely my Times editor, she's never said this, and it's a really sensitive topic to be like, because it makes you self-conscious when you're writing, but I think that that's something that she cuts from me.
Okay.
So like, she protects me from that like kind of Irish whiskey drinking, like, oh, what's going to become of us all? Like, I've noticed that she kind of tightens that out, which is okay. Helpful.
And what does that process actually look like? Does she send back your work with red lines drawn through it, or on a computer program with a
yeah, just on Word, I guess, in the lines, the spaces beside it.
Okay.
She doesn't show me what she's cut. Okay. Which is good, I think, because...
Oh, that's it. I think that's what I was meaning to ask. Right. Yeah, okay.
Right,
she
no.
She doesn't.
No. So, which is cool, because sometimes, like, you read over it and you're like, oh, that's really good, really strong piece, and there's nothing missing. And then it's like, wait a second, that was, like, 1,500 words before, and now it's 1,200 words. Like, then you see what's missing. But I genuinely, you know, how there's supposedly, like, two sides of your brain, and one is the creative and one is the editor, like, your own internal editor. And, like, when they get muddied up, that's paralysis right there. So when I'm writing, I try not to... and I have all these like crazy methods, but like, I really try not to let that critical editor voice in, and I just try and like go for it and then trust that like she'll catch me, and you know, I won't be made a fool of.
Please tell us some of the crazy methods.
Oh, of drowning out the...
Yeah, that is 100% the wheelhouse of this show.
So if my brain is really frenetic, I sometimes have to wait until I'm extremely tired. So, like, I keep myself really busy all day, and then I just sit down at, like, 1 a.m., and, like, when my body is very, very tired, and I really want to go to sleep, and then I'm like, when you reach 500 words, you can go to sleep. And at that point, my brain is often too, it's just worn out. So, like, the residue is what I've been wanting to say.
So you're too tired to fight. Critically block yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. That's great.
But those days are tense, right? Because like all that day, like I'm just trying to wear myself out, and I'm just like, I'm going to write tonight. And then another thing I do is listen to like very loud music, which is a thing that Stephen King recommended.
Okay.
And I listen to very loud music on my headphones, and... If any thoughts come in that aren't what I'm writing, then I have a notepad beside me and I just like put them down there.
That's great.
So, you know, if it's like bad, fake, like stupid or whatever, then I just like quickly write.
Oh, like negative self-thoughts.
Negative thoughts, editorial thoughts, or even just like, I have to buy avocados, like whatever else trips in that's not supposed to be there. And I also listen to the same, like when I wrote my last book, I listened to the same album. I listened to like Frank Ocean album, the same one. Like I listened to it maybe 1,000 times. So that it's like, now I can't hear it because I'm like, wait, I'm in the place.
Okay, so you deliberately overplay it in order that it creates a kind of hypnotic.
Yeah.
So it's noise. It's almost like white noise kind of thing. So there's something...
Yeah, I think Zadie Smith uses actually, like, she has a program like a pink noise where she uses to write. So I think it's probably this combination of like her advice and Stephen King's advice which is to just like drown it out and
you drown it in Frank Ocean.
Oh yeah, totally. Like, oh yeah, that's so true. So that really works. And then, you know, what used to work for me, it stopped working now, unfortunately, was setting a timer and, you know, not letting myself move until I had done a certain word count.
Okay.
In 45 minutes.
Okay. But and do you stick to that? Is that like, given that for me, that's one of those things, like, if I leave a thing there, then I'll always do that when I see the thing. And of course, what the issue you're trying to solve is self-discipline.
Yeah.
And so you don't have the discipline to actually do the system that you set.
Exactly.
Yourself. That's the challenge I would have, I think.
Exactly. Like I said, it worked for me. That's how I did my first book. And I was like, doesn't matter if you really have to go to the toilet, you can just sit here and wet yourself if you're, you know, you're not allowed to move. But now that discipline has somehow left me. I can't seem to manage that anymore.
The discipline of wetting yourself.
I should say, I just wet myself. I'm just walking around, piddling.
So just to come back to the two different editors, what are some of the differences between them?
I think, given
that they're both very useful to you.
Yeah, so, like, I suppose the other thing is, like, the product they're making is very different. So, like, Rachel is in charge of the paper, which is, like, a weekly paper, and I guess the New York Times has a kind of a voice too, so like some of my phrases or the way I say things like don't fit, so she changes them, so there's like little technical things like that, and that's her brief, right? But then Sarah, my other editor at the book, is unbelievably encouraging and supportive, like to the point where sometimes I would like feel tears welling up, because like I think it's common of stand-up comedians and people like us in general to be, you know, have like a constant little trickle of self-loathing going on, like whatever way you work at it, it seems to be part of our makeup. And she would just be so loving. And like when you're writing a book or writing a full show, it's like you go kind of crazy, right? Like it's a very self-absorbed, like tough process. And so, you know, I missed a big deadline for my book, actually. And I was sure, you know, I was like, this is it, you know, like, this is where it all comes crumbling down. And of course, you couldn't handle it. You got this deal. You couldn't do, you know, like, I was like in a bad place. And she just, you know, sent back notes on the latest thing, which I felt was like rambling and terrible. And she just sent back like very encouraging, like loving notes on it. And also, you know, said, that's fine. You missed the deadline. That's fine. Like, let's see where we are headed, you know, over the next few months. And that point was so critical for me. And like, that was not just an editor, that was like a human reaction that she had, I think. And like, I never talked to her about this, actually. So like, I don't know if this is like a method that they that they learn in editor school where they're like, writers are demented, so we have to be very nice to them, or like they, you know.
I love the idea of editor school.
You know, like,
choose your hat. Are you going to? There's two ways we can treat them. you know, if you're a black hat or a white hat editor.
Yeah. Are you going to be like a cruel? Because like, I wish that she would be sometimes. Like I was like, how is this lady telling me this piece is good when I know it's nonsense? Like I was like, I don't trust her. You know, like really. Wishing that she would be like, okay, that's it, Maeve, you've reached the limit, and now, you know, you're in deep trouble here, and like goodbye, and we want our money back. I was like, why isn't she doing that? I don't know why she's not doing that. Ultimately, her way worked because I got the book finished, and it's like, you know, whatever, it's done. So yeah, I don't know. It's a fascinating unsung position, because like you can tell a bad editor in a second, you know, when you're reading something, you're just like, eesh, like this could have done with a hand.
I remember hearing, I think probably on a Mark Kermode podcast or one of his books, about how the editor of a movie is kind of more important than the director.
Oh yeah, with a movie especially, I'd say. Don't you think?
I don't know anything about, I don't really know anything more than that about the role of an editor in movies, just that surprising idea that, yeah, the director decides all this, like in the same way that the actor gives the director loads of options and then doesn't know which one is going to get used. I guess the director gives the editor loads of options, loads of shots, and then the editor actually makes the movie.
Yeah, they decide like what gets seen.
Yeah, it's this is huge. I don't know if I can say any more about that because I don't know anything more about it.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I think they are such a funny, unsung, you know, it's a very powerful position that they have too, right? Because they can change and decide like what gets to be, you know, say, especially if you're in like a newspaper, you get to say like, this is going in or this is not going in.
Yeah, that would be great. I just, given how much I enjoy performing but hate writing stand-up, like the idea that someone generate the stuff and then you decide which of the stuff is mm-hmm. the best stuff, that mm-hmm. sounds good. I mean, that's the best bit of any writing process that I undergo, is if I'm writing a show for Edinburgh in August, July can be a lot of fun if I feel like I've got enough in the tank.
Yeah.
Because actually you can go, I don't need that bit anymore. Get rid of it. Oh, God, this is bliss. I feel powerful rather than this kind of lonely, scared animal that I am at this time of year.
Yes, yeah, when you're starting from nothing. And
Yeah,
that's the worst. And, like, I guess maybe a good editor understands that part too, you know, so they're not too harsh. Because, mm-hmm. Because, I mean, they couldn't work without us, I suppose, you know.
Tell me what your book is about, the first one.
Basically, what I write is like memoir, comedy memoir essays.
Okay, yes.
So they're like short essays. And so the first book was kind of... I actually have two books that came out in Ireland and the UK,
okay.
and they're both the same. Like, they're both like comedy memoir essays, and they kind of cover, you know, growing up and the usual like comedian memoir stuff, like growing up and being a woman. And, you know, I wrote an essay about like having a stalker and... I can't even remember. And also like really silly stuff, like short form, like I'm trying to, like, where I would imagine different scenarios that I was in and stuff. So just like comedy writing.
And what's the relationship between the creative process for those and the creative process for when you're writing stand-up?
Well, I think I was always so lazy with stand-up. I mean, I still think, like, so last night I had a show and I was on the flight to Austin, you know, thinking like, oh, I need to put my set together, you know, like, so last minute sloppy, you know, feeling anxious about it, but not doing anything about it. Like,
oh, yeah.
That's like,
oh yeah, I know that.
So, and the thing with, you know, writing for publication is like, you don't get away with that. Like, you have to have your work done. And so there's a real adrenaline rush with stand-up too, right? Because you're like, I didn't even practice for this. And like, I just have like
I'm rewarded for my procrastination. Yeah. It worked. I got away with it. So it means that it must be fine to be on the plane panicking.
Exactly. Yeah. I've been getting away with it for years. And like, you know, it's often better because I'm like frightened. So like all these like whatever... frightened hormones get released and I say something really funny and, you know, like, I don't know what it is, but I think that's the process that I've become like addicted to with stand up. And often it doesn't work. Like, you get on stage, you're like, oh fuck, I really wish I would have had some kind of set down. And, you know, like, yeah, it's so scary. But yeah, I think creatively, like, what I'm finding the most satisfying, like, I think I probably am repeating myself, but like, is when I write something, it seems to be more what I meant, you know, whereas like, yes. On stage, I'm still like, it's not that like stand-up is lacking. It's like me as a stand-up, because when I see stand-ups that I love, like, like Maria Bamford or Josie Long, I'm like, oh, they're like in the flow, like they are exactly where they should be. And I'm hearing what's happening in their heads right now. And that's why it's so resonant. That's why it's so funny. That's like why they're so good, you know. But I never got to that level.
And what stopped you from getting that to that level, do you think?
I think because my...
And I'm not agreeing with you, because I think you're a fantastic stand-up. So I think, you know what I mean? Like, when I saw it, I remember seeing you in San Francisco. I'd seen you before, but I remember just going, wow, this must be what happens when you go to America. You know, because it seemed so coherent. And exactly as you say, I felt like I could see what was happening in your head.
Right. I mean, that was probably a good show, right? But I would say that's not been consistent for me. And also that I've never, and this is like, so, but you know, like, if I cared about it enough, I'd be number one or whatever. But like, I do think that I never applied myself to stand up in the way that I applied myself to other other things that I'm interested in. Whereas, like, I see stand-up, I just, like, I compare it a lot to, like, being in a bad relationship. You know, it's, like, a boyfriend that I kind of want to break up with that I never fully do. And, like, he's a bit shitty to me, but, like, it's okay. And, you know, he leads to other things and whatever. You know, like, that's kind of where I see stand-up. Like, I've never been, like, fully, like, in love with it, where I've been, like, I want to, like, really be at one with this art form. You know, like, I don't really watch that many shows. Like, last night I watched almost a full show and it was a pleasure, but I found myself, like, looking at the audience and, like, thinking about them and, like, thinking about what the comedian was saying in, like, a bigger way. And, you know, thinking, like, you know, I just couldn't sit there and enjoy it, like, basically.
Are you happy
doing stand up?
Interpret it however you like.
Oh, well, I mean, like, I think I want to do better work is what I would say there. Yeah. I think I, like, have a feeling that, like, I need to, like, be to like match the moment that we're in. I don't feel satisfied with my contribution is what I would say, you know?
Okay.
You look so confused.
No. I was trying to do active listening and get you to continue speaking. Because I think there's a lot more to get out of that. And I'm kind of, it's not that I'm confused. I'm sort of trying to debate what's the best way to find out more about what you mean. And also there's a kind of aspect of it where I'm interested in your actual mental health besides just creative happiness. And I was trying to decide whether to ask that in a minute or now.
I've never been accused of looking
confused before on my own thing. Sorry, everyone. I'm quite late night out.
Like, no, but, like, I know, like a little puppy dog. Like, whoa, wait, where did the treat go? I think they're very linked, for me anyway. Like, my kind of mental health state and, like, how my, and my work. Like, they're very intertwined. So I think, yeah, those two things are more than even, like, my personal life and my mental health. It's like, I think that's just when you're a creative person, right? It's like you, if it's not coming out, then it's like you're in trouble.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting you say, and we must wrap up, but
yeah.
With regard to this kind of more recent expansion of your horizons in terms of wanting to say something in the moment, you know, going to Iraq, working with other people, kind of looking outside of yourself, and the effect that that has had on your creativity and on your happiness. Like, do you feel that it's almost like, do you feel that because you've recognized that you are that you could be doing more to say something more, does that make you happier that you feel like you have more of a quest that you're on? Or does it make you less happy because it throws a light on your previous work?
I think probably less happy. Like, I think oblivion, like being oblivious is like a charmed existence. You know, when you're just like, oh, this is fine. Oh, cool. Like, oh, cool. I'm going to go to Australia. Yes, Edinburgh is happening. I'm going to see my friend. You know, like that, which is what I did for many years. And like, I was always in my head. I was like, you're not really like achieving what you need to achieve, like with your brain and your work and stuff. But I was like having a fun time. and now, like, as you say, I'm like, wait, like, this is maybe it's something to do with, like, in your 30s, you're like more, oh, like, this is a real world. And like, these are your consequences of, like, this is what's happening. And I think that it's hard. Like, it's hard. It's kind of a painful spot to be in. And also realizing that you're not the center of the world. And not only that, like, what you do is very, you know, at best, you can have a tiny impact, like at best. Like if you're like operating on full throttle, you're still just like one tiny person. So like, I think that's like not a fun realization, but like, I'm okay with that. Like I don't want to be like a happy, oblivious person, you know, like I'm fine with it. But yeah, I would say like, I'm not such a giddy goat.
And will you go back to Iraq?
Hopefully, yeah, I want to. Yeah, yeah. I'm just trying to figure out, like, yeah, this year. I don't have any plans to, but I'm like working on a few different things and I'm trying to get back and do more cool stuff.
I thought it was really interesting that you described the first time you mentioned those comics working in Iraq, or, you know, satirical or sketch comics, to just describe them as my peers in Iraq seemed to be a very conscious way of thinking about them. Rather than, oh, I was going over there and there's some guys out there that do some stuff. Actually, to see your peers as a global group is very uncommon.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's because, you know, we are English speakers, we're white, we're Westerners, so it's ingrained in us to think that, like, we're better than the rest of the world. And, you know, we're not. We're the same. We're just all the same. But the other funny thing is, I was aware of that and I was, like, being conscious of that. Like, I was like, I'm not about to go out here and, like, teach them. Like, no, that's not happening. But the other thing was, then I went out there and like, one particular sketch group, they were called Educated Butt, so these Kurdish lads, and I was like, oh my god, it's Pappy's Fun Club. I was like, Tom? Like, Matthew? Like, genuinely, like, goofballs are the same all over the world.
Oh,
like,
that's magic.
It's amazing. You know, and there was, like, a quiet girl there with her boyfriend, and I was like, that's, you know, like, I know you. Like, I met you in Edinburgh. You're the funny one. Like, you know? There was, like, versions of us, like, there. So that was a really, like, I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't, like, that enlightened that I understood that until I went there. And I was also like, holy shit, like, they have so much better material than we do. Because you know how, like, you're writing an Edinburgh show and you're like, you know, okay, let's get real here. Let's get deep, you know? And then, like, what do we have? Like, oh, like, we're, you know, something slightly bad happened to us before. But, like, talk to these Iraqi people and they have, like, proper real life. And I'm not saying it's better to have tragedy in your life, but I'm saying their experiences make them so much more in tune to, like, the realities of life and death and the big questions, you know, whereas we're like, train travel is hard.
And that's, I mean, it is, that's a really, I feel like it's an exciting time to have caught you. In terms of you kind of exploding and rebuilding and working out what you want from it next. That includes writing, yeah, comic writing is more so than stand-up, it sounds like, to you at the moment.
Yeah.
To be... Like, where do you want to take it? Where can you see
I don't know, you know what's so funny? Because I had lunch with John Hodgman, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he... Because, you know, we had this lunch because I wanted to thank him because he gave me a blurb for my book. And so we did, like, talk about work stuff a little bit. And at one point I heard myself being like, of course I want to do comedy, but, like, you know, with a point, like, comedy with a point. And, like, we both just, like, burst out laughing. So silly, you know, like, oh god. Yeah, so I haven't figured it out yet. So a lot of rambling has happened on the show. You're definitely going to need your editorial skills.
Absolutely
to, like, make sense of it.
Living it all in, especially the puppy dog accusation. But yeah, absolutely. Comedy with a point. And that feels like, you know, I feel like I can imagine comics listening to this, snapping their pencils, going, no, it's not supposed to have a point.
Yeah.
In a way that you obviously know.
I feel that too. Yeah,
yeah.
It's really conflicting. Yeah. It's really conflicting. And so maybe I'm going to be like, you know what? Just leave comedy. But I cannot seem to leave it. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, I keep coming back because my favorite thing to do is to, like, joke and laugh around. Like, that's, like, my favorite thing to do. Like, last night at the I was backstage, like, you know, Conor O'Malley, he's like, oh my God. He's like this kid, he's from Chicago and he's like, writes, how would you know him? Anyway, he's just like a very funny, backstage he was like doing funny voices and I was like dying. Like, I was like legitimately like, this is the most fun you can have, just like being with a bunch of like funny people in like a green room that stinks of nachos and like talking shit about people and like doing impressions. Like, it's so much fun. You know, but then there's another side to me where I'm like, okay, I'm writing a column about Syria today.
Is it possible to keep those things separate? Could you do comedy for its own sake and life that has a point? Do you know what I mean? Like,
it's just like, how can you do that though? Everything bleeds into each other, you know? So I don't know if I can figure that out. Like, that'll be interesting, you know, to see. But for now, it feels messy.
So that was Maeve. Do find out about her. Find out more about her stuff. She has an album on Spotify, I can tell you that much. She has a podcast called Maeve in America. She has more than one podcast. She has, is it Laugh and Learn? Laughing and Learning? Something like that. Really make an effort to track down Maeve's stuff. And certainly if you ever discover that she's coming back to the UK or indeed wherever you're based, do make the effort to go and see her. She has such a gentle... And I did say meandering. I hope that didn't come across negatively, but it is this, what it's like, it's the appearance, the illusion of meandering. And she's just, because of that, she's one of these, it's just one of those acts that you could just watch again and again and again. I think she's fantastic and very exciting to see her at South by brackets Southwest. I kept wanting to go on and say, welcome everyone, we're at SX by West or whatever, but glad I didn't now. Sounds awful. So there is more stuff, lots more content. I recorded another one with Nick Thune, fantastic comedian and now a film actor as well. He's got some jokes. Oh my God, Nick is like, he's like a former one-liner merchant who understands comedy from the inside, from that kind of fulcrum point that Gary Delaney talked about. He really gets that and now does a totally different style, but built on the bones of that deep understanding of how short, punchy jokes work. So he's great. I had a really interesting interview with him, which included him talking about looking through, being given the opportunity to look through Mitch Hedberg's notes after Mitch's passing. He was able, with a friend, to go through them first part of it. You'll hear all about it. But if you know who Mitch Hedberg is, imagine how exciting that concept is to me. Oh, my God. So another non-live one with Nick. And then next week, as soon as we've downloaded the files, which I am sure exist online somewhere, then we have the series of... From next week, we have the series of the three live podcasts I recorded at South by Southwest, which were with James Davis. Get your homework done on James Davis. Have a little look for Hood Adjacent on YouTube. It's genuinely hilarious and sort of... I mean, I'm going to say kind of important, very insightful and incisive comedy. So check out James Davis, Ron White, a titan of American comedy and someone that I didn't know who he was about 2 months ago. But isn't it an incredible art form that you can just go, oh, suddenly you look at someone and go, oh, Christ, he's released hundreds of albums. He's been famous for 25 years. And so we had a lot to talk about there and I got to sort of explore some of his... stance on the world, some of which is lose that. I got to explore his stance on comedy in the world, and of course Beth Stelling, who many of you will know from The Stand-Ups, the 6-part half-hour series of Netflix specials, and someone who I've seen gig previously as well. So some really great episodes coming your way very soon. I hope you stick around and enjoy all of them. So I will chat to you briefly after. Sorry about the echo here. It's very much a backstage recording, this one. I'll stick around and post-amble at you. And if you don't fancy hanging around for that, then this concludes the podcast and I'll speak to you next week. Comedianscomedian.com/donate to support the show that you love so much and that you're thinking, God, everyone else seems to be donating. I better get on board. Or you're thinking, wow, no one else seems to be donating. I better get on board. Either of those versions of the flowchart. Very much acceptable to me. Speak to you soon. So here I am. I made it to Nottingham. If you're someone who was coming to the Dublin show, I continue to be deeply apologetic. And when I woke up this morning to discover there were 3 inches of snow around the house and the little hill on which we live... and as a result, the car was very precariously... Didn't do anything with the car the previous night... didn't realise it was going to be quite so snowy. Got a bit panicky. Really hoped Nottingham wasn't going to get pulled. I'm now in Nottingham. So I'm backstage looking at the charming sunflowers and pictures that they have. I mean, it's a very nice dressing room, this one. I'm at the Glee Club. And I mean, this is of no consequence. So what will I talk to you about? South by Southwest, my God. What a privilege to be part of that
to be just part of it. You get a little laminate and you wander around, and when you go and see panels on things, they beep your laminate so they know you're there, and you feel like you're constantly being like RFID tracked all over the place. And you almost certainly are. And apparently a big thing with South by Southwest is you go past famous people. Nile Rodgers was the most I managed. And I did see a talk with Elon Musk, but from another room watching a screen projection. But I was at the Westworld thing. I was at the Westworld panel. I didn't get to go to Sweetwater. They built the cowboy town from Westworld and had 100 actors doing stuff. But thanks to my friend Steve, I did manage to take home one of the hats. A black hat, which if you're watching that show, you'll know is deeply significant. I saw robot arms, a smart aquarium. I sat on the actual Batmobile. I just had so much fun. So I owe a huge debt of gratitude and profuse thanks to the brilliant Charlie Sotelo, who was kind enough to broker my trip and invite me out there. So thank you, Charlie. And I'll send you that ludicrous picture of you eating brisket as soon as I get it back from the developers. So really good fun. A quick shout out to everyone I met and hung out with and had so much fun performing with, talking to and podcasting. Did I learn anything? I think I did. I think it's one of those places that is just so inspiring. I felt a bit like the first time I went to Edinburgh when I was 16 and I just got my mind unpeeled. I had a similar kind of reaction to this incredible festival full of electric cars driving around in 20-foot bubbles and ludicrous human drum machines and death metal bands in every shop window. It was mind-blowing. And I hope what I've come away from it with is a bit of a deeper understanding of the possibilities of podcasting. I'm forever saying that the guys in America are 5 or 10 years ahead of us in terms of what they're doing with the form. There are podcast networks all over the place in the States. I don't really think we have one in the UK. Maybe there are some UK podcasts affiliated with one. And I suppose one of the most exciting things was being really reinvigorated about how this show is independent. I remember when I started, I would occasionally be in the sort of podcast top 100. I am now very occasionally as well. But nowadays, every radio station, every commercial organisation chops up and pumps out all of their radio output. Now that it exists, why not? Of course they would. They chop it up and pump it out as a podcast. And that tends to occupy an awful lot of the space. So I one of the most exciting things was going to this festival, going to panels about podcasting and the digital world, and just learning from a point of view of someone. It just made me feel like a keen idiot that was just running around trying to learn from everyone and trying to go, yes, I've got this thing now. It's been going for 5 years plus, and it's got a really engaged audience and a strong back catalogue and a good central point. And now I feel like, okay, I've been just sort of maybe plateauing. I feel like I've been getting better. I hope you think the interviews have been getting better. But I've had so much else on, writing a new show every year, developing all sorts of other projects, that I tell you what it is. I tell you, this is the single most exciting element of it. At a podcast panel, three of the guests were asked by Julie Shapiro from the Radiotopia Network, what is your most valuable resource? And someone said my office, and someone said my time. And the third person, whose name I can't completely remember, it may or may not have been Wendy. It says so in a note I wrote down somewhere, but apologies to whoever you are if you're not Wendy. Someone said, management. My most precious resource is management. And it makes me realise that I realised this several times. I do not use my time. I don't self-manage anything like as well as I could do. I perpetually take on too much. I answer every email I'm sent. Someone actually laughed on the panel when someone said, oh, because I answer all of the emails. One of the other podcasters went, you what? They couldn't imagine answering all the emails. I do. And, you know, not for some months, as many of you know. But my time is so precious, and I manage it so often so badly that I end up worrying about a small, easily achievable thing, procrastinating about it. It becomes this enormous thing. And as a result, I end up freaking out and ignoring it. And then it snowballs and then everything gets, you know, I mean, this is another classic Goals with Post-Avil about anxiety, but through the lens of how I use my time and how I continue to, how in God's name I continue to do all the things I want to do and also do all the other things I want to do whilst doing all the things in the background. Oh, God, there's probably an app for it. But that's it. There's hundreds of apps for it. But what you need is the self-management to go, nope, I'm going to use that one and that one. And that's the bit I'm lacking. Is there an app that can tell me what apps to choose and how to activate them? God, there probably is. But how do I choose that one? Goodbye. I'm disappearing down a management wormhole. I'll speak to you next week. In the meantime, comedianscomedian.com/tour. Come out and see the stand-up show. It's been so much fun. And we're in the second quarter of the tour now, and I'm really looking forward to it. I'm firing on all gun cylinders. Not a phrase. Speak to you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.